We've come to chapter 7. So far in this gospel, since we just finished this section, we'll do a little review. Luke wrote this gospel, if you remember, so the reader would have certainty concerning the things that they were taught, a comprehensive narrative of the good news of Jesus Christ. From the birth of John the Baptist, who would go before the Lord to prepare his way, through Jesus' humble birth in Bethlehem, we've studied the word and we've seen his baptism and the time in the wilderness being tempted. We saw how Jesus began his ministry and how Luke points out very early in this gospel that Jesus' own people, his own family, his own neighbors, the people of Nazareth would reject him. And despite his authority and teaching, healing, and cleansing, instead of rejoicing at this homegrown son of theirs, they resented him and they were filled with wrath. We've come to see the growing hatred of the Jewish leaders, the scribes and the Pharisees, because he tends to call out their hypocrisy. So far in the gospel, he hasn't done so directly at them. He's done it by showing his love and showing his grace and by showing the way in which he loves people. It illustrates for everyone around them just how hypocritical the scribes and the Pharisees were in the way that they acted. They didn't like this Jesus, this Messiah, because of the way that he shows this love and affection for the sick and the needy and the lost. The fact that he made no excuses for the fact that he came to save sinners. And the people that had a really rough time with Jesus were those folks that didn't see themselves as sinners. They saw themselves as righteous. He's called the 12 apostles from among his many disciples. We just finished the first extended sermon that Luke places here in the beginning. It's a sermon that lays out clearly that there's going to be true followers, authentic disciples who will be true to the end, and there's false followers, worldly disciples who will fall away when even the easiest testing comes. In that sermon, he gave many comparisons to know one from the other so that we might be certain that we are authentic, children of the Most High, saved by his grace. And now Luke moves us on into the narrative to show us more of the ministry, the teaching, the serving of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And what's really neat about the way Luke presents his gospel is that Luke doesn't just show you what Jesus is doing. Jesus shows us the reactions of the people in who he's serving and who he's doing it to. And what you find with Luke is quite frequently he gives you this comparison throughout the gospel, a right reaction and a wrong reaction. And so when you're studying Luke's gospel, it's always interesting to watch and to look because you'll always see these comparisons that he makes because he's wanting you to be certain, right? If you come back to his purpose for writing this gospel, he wants you to be confident. He wants you to have this great trust in this word. And so he keeps showing you this is a right reaction. This is not a right reaction because he wants you to be certain. He wants you to keep coming back to the old way. He wants you to keep coming back to the word, keep coming back to the cross, keep coming back to Jesus Christ. And so we're at chapter 7, beginning with verse 1. Word of the Lord. After he had finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. Now a centurion had a servant who was sick and at the point of death, who was highly valued by him. When the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent to him elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they pleaded with him earnestly, saying, "He is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he is the one who built us our synagogue." And Jesus went with them. When he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you. But say the word, and let my servant be healed. For I too am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes. And to my servant, 'Do this,' and he does it." And when Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him. Turning to the crowd that followed him, he said, "I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith." And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the servant well. So reads the word of the Lord. It's a simple little section, and I think it's neat that we come to this section on Memorial Day weekend. Isn't it interesting? We come here and we're going to talk this morning about a centurion, a soldier, a military man. This exemplary centurion who is an honorable, faithful military man. As we as a country pause to remember this weekend, all of those, the many such soldiers who've laid down their lives in service to our country, specifically those that gave up their lives so that we might be safe and remain free, you almost have to stop for a moment as I was even writing that in the sermon and pray that God would help us not to squander nor abuse that freedom. Something as you stop for a moment, you think, and even in the Bible, what's interesting, we're going to find that the centurions throughout the New Testament are always painted with a very good brush. There's something about these centurions that they're lifted. Anyway, it's neat that we're in this section on a day such as this. So we come to chapter 7, verse 1. Jesus had completed the sermon or the series of talks, right? If it wasn't one complete sermon, it was at least a series of talks with his disciples and those that were following him. And all the multitudes that had come out to see him and had heard him, they're still kind of following behind. And now they've come to the town of Capernaum, which is his home base. You find that throughout the gospel that he kind of goes out and comes back, goes out and comes back. This is the place where he finds safety, his comfort zone here. And we're introduced in verse 2 to a centurion. A centurion is a Roman officer, and at one time, the reason they were called centurions is because it was a rank that indicated that he was in charge of 100 soldiers. And so that's how you get the idea of a centurion is someone who has 100 soldiers. Now, by the time of this with Jesus, it doesn't mean that they all had 100 soldiers. Some had 90, some had 120. It just kind of gives you an idea of the rank. Some have linked this rank to a sergeant major, or to a senior army captain or a major. It's somewhere in that middle officer ranks is where he was in the Roman army. The historian Polybius provides this description of the qualities that were needed to be a centurion during this time. And I think that they are kind of interesting, especially for us that have served. They must not be so much seekers after danger as men who can command, who are steady in action, and who are reliable. They ought not to be over anxious to rush into the fight, but more so, when hard pressed, these are men ready to hold their ground and to even die at their posts. These are men of fortitude, men of courage, integrity. These are men that others can follow. Isn't that great? This goes all the way back. This was a description of the centurions and what the requirements were for them. Men of fortitude, courage, integrity, men that others could follow. And like I said earlier, throughout the New Testament, we tend to see the centurions painted with a similar brush each time, men of strong character. So this centurion in Luke is a Roman. He's a Gentile. He's not a Jew. He's probably part of the Roman occupying forces who's overseeing the land and protecting all of the Roman interests. These Roman soldiers were hated for the most part throughout all of Israel because they were an occupying force. If you remember, what did the Jews were looking for in a Messiah? What did they want? They wanted a militant Messiah. They wanted a Messiah who was going to overtake Rome, that was going to overthrow their captivity and restore Israel to its sovereign status. So these Roman soldiers would have been people that had been hated by the Jews. But this centurion wasn't. And he's called out in Luke's gospel. Verse 2, this centurion had a servant, a slave in his household, who was gravely sick, even at the point of death. Luke ensures that we understand that this is not just a little sick. He wants you to understand that all hope was gone and this servant was about to die. And the centurion highly valued this servant, this slave. And I want you to understand that the word that's used here doesn't mean that the servant was strong and valuable, worth a lot of money to him. That's not the way the term is used. The term used means precious. This servant was precious to the centurion. This servant was very close to his heart. Starts to show you, right, the first picture of this centurion, that he has this servant, this slave that works for him, that's very close to his heart. He's very concerned for his well-being. And this servant was close to death. In verse 3, when the centurion heard about Jesus, what did he hear? You know, you think about this, right? It says, he heard about Jesus. What? What did he hear? What he had heard was that Jesus heals with authority. That Jesus casts out demons with authority. That Jesus teaches with authority. People would say that he teaches and he heals unlike any that they had ever seen or heard of before. So when this centurion heard this, he sent for Jesus. And what's interesting is he sent for him through the local elders, the local Jewish elders. He asked them if they would go and see if he would come. He sent them to ask Jesus to come and heal his servant. You know, this is the first thing in this section that's surprising, right? First, it's surprising that he would ask the Jewish leaders to go. Second, in verse 4, it's very surprising that they went on behalf of him. So it's kind of it starts to show you there's an odd relationship here between this centurion and the Jewish leaders of this small town. They went willingly. How do we know that? Because they came to Jesus and earnestly pleaded. Right? The way that they termed this, earnestly pleaded. They weren't just obeying the centurion. Hey, the guy, the big soldier that lives in our town, he wants you to come and heal his guy. Right? That's not at all how they came. They came to Jesus and they earnestly pleaded. And the word means with full heart intent. They came to Jesus wanting him to help this centurion. They came to Jesus saying, you really got to help this guy. He's a good guy. And what's interesting is look at what they say to Jesus. He is worthy to have you do this for him. Ooh, right? This gives you a picture of the Jewish thought. Coming to Jesus, the Son of God, saying, this one deserves you to come and help him. Yikes. Jewish thought was, he's a good man, so he deserves your help. He's earned your time. He's earned this. And their justification was, one, he loves our nation. Two, he's the one who built us our synagogue. That's kind of strange, right? What can you infer from that justification? For this centurion to love the nation of Israel indicates to some level a love for their God, right? Because this nation of Israel was absolutely all about, right? What set them apart? What made them set apart from all the other nations was their God. For him to love this nation was, in a sense, to love their God, at least to have an appreciation. It's very unusual for a conquering occupier to love the people. And another clue to his heart that he had an affection or at least a respect for this God is that he's the one who built our synagogue. Not every town could afford to build and have a synagogue. And so this small town was able to have a synagogue because either this centurion put up the money for it, or at least he put in the labor for it. One of the two, right? These people felt that he was responsible for the fact that they had a synagogue. This is outside of his official duties. This isn't what centurions did. He had a love for these people, and he helped to build their little synagogue. And so these Jews believed that he was worthy of Jesus coming to heal on his behalf. Based on what he'd done, they considered him to be worthy of Jesus. You got to let that sink in a little bit, right? Because I have my first side note here. Because this is a common belief that somehow we need to be deserving and worthy of the good that God does to us. Or we see a lot of people who are deserving and worthy of the bad stuff God does to them. We get this really weird sense. And what I want you to stop and think is, can we earn God's favor, his grace? When I ask it that way, of course we answer and we go, no, of course not. All of us know the right words to say, no, we cannot earn grace. But I'll tell you, so often I hear you speak of God, whether in times of great trial, when we go through those rough times, saying, I don't know what I did to deserve this. And we go looking for, somehow I really ticked off God because he's done all these bad things. And on the good side, there's those people that say, wow, I really must have done something good because look at all the blessings that's coming my way. Right? We tend to link this blessing or those troubling times based on what we've done. Somehow we deserve the good that's in our life. Somehow we deserve the bad that's in our life. You know, if those of you that were in the world religions class with us, what was one of those things that was similar in all of man's religions that man creates? This idea of karma, right? This idea of scales and keeping everything in the balance. This idea that if we do good, we get good. If we do bad, we get bad, right? Every single one of man's religions, you look across them, has some element of that karmic balance. Ours is different. God's religion is different because it's based on grace. Not getting what you deserve. A matter of fact, absolutely getting what you absolutely don't deserve, what you are absolutely unworthy of, that is when God's love shines and shows you what mercy looks like. We see people working so hard to earn God's favor. You hear people, oh, if only I did more for him. If only I would be more for him. If only I would give more to him. Then God would bless me because I could earn it. Be careful. Right? You got to be really careful. Even those of us who have been in the church a long time, it seeps in, doesn't it? Some of us that have been here going, I'm a big grace preacher. It still seeps in sometimes into our lifestyle and the way we think and the things that we do and the ways in which we tell people. You know, it's the heart attitude of the prodigal son's brother, isn't it? When you think about what was wrong with the brother, he couldn't get excited when his prodigal brother returned and his dad had this great festival, right? And he killed the fatted calf and he's doing this and the brother was mad. I stayed here and worked at your side. I deserve the fatted calf, not him. I won't even come in the house. The father says, please come in. Right? The father kind of begs him and says, you've been with me all along. But the son was mad. I worked too hard for this. He's not going to get it for free. That heart of thinking that I deserve better. I deserve more. He doesn't deserve that. That's the heart that starts to simmer when we start thinking that we earn things. You know, turn with me to Matthew chapter 20. There's another parable that Jesus gives. And a lot of people really hate this parable. And they look at it, and the reason is because we understand the ones who are angry in this parable. We understand the heart that they have. Chapter 20. For the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And to them he said, you go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right, I will give you. So they went. Going out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same. And about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing. And he said to them, why do you stand here idle all day? They said to him, because no one's hired us. He said to them, you go into the vineyard too. And when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first. And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each one of them received a denarius. Now when those hired first came, they thought they would receive a lot more. But each of them also received a denarius. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house, saying, these last worked only 1 hour, and you've made them equal to us who've borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat. But he replied to one of them, friend, I'm doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last worker as I gave to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity? So the last will be first and the first last. Yikes. That last sentence. Do you begrudge my generosity? Do you hate my grace? That's what he's saying. You don't like it, do you? You don't like grace. We like grace when it's ours. We're not so big of a fan when it's somebody else's, right? It's we work for this. These all-day workers thought they would receive more for working harder and longer. But God chooses what to do, when to do it. He chooses with great generosity, and it's not based on our worthiness, thank God. No, it's based on his goodness. And despite our unworthiness, he loved us first, undeserved. Anyway. Beloved, we work hard out of our love for him, for what he's done. We don't work hard for him, hoping to get him to do some things for us. Anyway, verse 6. Jesus went with them. Right? Even though they came and they said, we think he's worthy of you coming, Jesus went. And as they came near to the centurion's home, the centurion sent friends to meet them. Ryken is one of the commentators I use for this section, and he notes something that when I first went through the study, I didn't understand why he noted this. But he notes that it's obvious that there has been notice sent forward that Jesus is on the way getting near. And with it, what was said to get him here, right? What Ryken wants you to understand is, how did this take place? These friends he sent to get Jesus to come. Jesus is now coming, but when Jesus comes, he's coming with a multitude, right? There's a whole lot of folks coming. And so what he wants you to understand is the centurion is hearing back and forth. This is what they said to get him here. This is what's going on. They're getting near. And so you start to understand. And I think it's interesting because you'll see why I think Ryken brings it out, and I think he's absolutely right to bring it out. The centurion's friends tell Jesus, they meet with him as he's getting close to the city, close to his house, and this is the message that the centurion gave to his friends to give to Jesus. Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come even under my roof. Do you see the contrast? Here's one of Luke's contrasts. The Jews go, he's worthy to have you come. First thing that this centurion gives back is, I am not worthy to have you come, even under my roof. Now, the commentators here make note, Jesus never went into a Gentile home that is recorded. Did you know that? I thought that was interesting. I started looking. You don't find that Jesus went into a Gentile home. This would have been the one if he had gone in. But he was stopped. The centurion was worried about Jesus' ritual purity because he was close to the Jews. He helped build their synagogue. He understood their customs. He understood that if this man of the Jews was to come into his house, all of the people would see him as unclean and unpurified, no longer a part of it. And so he's got concern for the customs, concern to keep him clean and pure, concern to keep him aside. Look at Acts 10, verse 28. Keith read this for us, the whole section, but I want you to see one thing that kind of comes out of these commentators that say it was not something that Jews did to go into Gentiles' homes. This is in Acts. This is after the Holy Spirit has come. This is after Pentecost. This is after a lot of these things. And we come to chapter 10 in Acts. Look at verse 28. And this is Peter talking, and he said to them, you yourselves know how unlawful it is for a Jew to associate with or to visit anyone of another nation. That means a Gentile. But God has shown me that I should not call any person common or unclean. What's interesting, when you read through this whole context of Acts chapter 10, what did it take for Peter to go in to this house? It took Peter a vision and God to repeat three times, what God has made clean, do not call common. To finally, reluctantly enter the centurion's home in Acts. If Jesus had entered the Gentile home during their time together, it wouldn't have been so precedent-setting here in Acts. That's what the commentators bring out. That this was a big deal. When Peter goes into the centurion's home in Acts 10, it's a big deal. It hasn't been done. This is precedent-setting. So yes, I think that some of the commentators' comments here are correct in what they bring out here. But the thing I think Luke brings out is most important not to miss. The centurion doesn't point to the uncleanness and the impurity of his house. right? The reason that it was impure, I went looking. The reason it was impure for a Jew to go into a Gentile's house is because there was all kinds of dietary and there was all kinds of uncleanness in that house. And to touch uncleanness in the house, to touch their food, it would be impolite. It would be horrific to think you'd be invited to their house and then not eat their food. So it was much easier to just not go. And so the issue was with the food that they ate and the uncleanness of their house. But what did the centurion say? His words weren't that his house was unclean. The centurion says, it was not the impurity of my house. He calls out this. He says, it's the unworthiness of myself. I am unworthy to have Jesus enter my house. This is that contrast that I think Luke points out through the gospel. The Jews said, come, for he is worthy. The centurion says, don't come, for I am unworthy. And beloved, this is the heart where faith takes root. This is the kind of heart that faith blossoms in. This heart of the centurion. Ephesians 2:8 says, for by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not of your own doing. It's the gift of God. So here's a side note here. This unworthy, the understanding that I'm not saved by my own doing, the knowing that only God can save, the knowing that God sent his Son to save sinners, the knowing that we cannot earn his favor, the knowing that we cannot keep the law on our own, the knowing that we cannot obey his word on our own. Only he can. Only he has. So the question is, well, then how do I get it? Do I earn it? No, I can't. It has to be given. It's a gift of God to be received. Understanding this, believing this, is this faith that's spoken of in Ephesians 2:8. Because God's word affirms again and again, it's by grace you've been saved, not your own doing. This is the heart where faith takes root. This noble, loving, good deed doing centurion, as Jesus came near, knew that he was unworthy of him. So he stopped Jesus from coming into his house. He didn't want to trouble Jesus for himself. Therefore, verse 7, look, he says, in the same line of thinking, look at what he says, I did not presume to come to you myself. Wow. That's something that, you know, this word that's used here for presume, it means to take for granted, to believe on an incomplete proof, to venture beyond due bounds, unreasonable confidence, arrogant overconfidence. These are the definitions of this word here that he uses. I did not have an arrogant overconfidence. I did not have an unreasonable confidence. I did not venture beyond due bounds. I didn't take you for granted. I did not presume to come to you myself. On behalf of himself, he's not worthy to call him into the house or to meet him. Do you see the the humility and the meekness of this centurion? But what is he willing to do? But say the word and let my servant be healed. I love this centurion, don't you? You see the heart that's you know what, for myself, I'm not worthy to come near you, but he, you could heal him. Please heal him. This is where this man's heart is, right where it's supposed to be. His confidence that's in Jesus is rooted in what? Look at verse 8. He says, for I too am a man set under authority. That's a huge sentence. You know, and it's not written the way we would think it is, because quite frequently we who are filled with ourselves would say, I too am a man of great authority. That's not what he says. He says, for I too am a man under authority. And what is he wanting you to see? He recognizes that Jesus is under authority. right? Remember, he teaches with authority. He heals with authority. He casts out demon with authority. That's what he's heard. It's an authority that they've never seen before. And all of these Jews that he loves, who are worshiping this God, who he's curious about at least, if not already embracing, this God is the only one, according to the Jews, who could do these things. So this centurion recognizes that Jesus is under authority. Whose? He doesn't come to meet him, so he knows that the authority is higher than Rome. He knows that this authority is higher than Caesar. He knows that this authority is an authority that can heal the sick and save the dying. This centurion realizes that this authority is God's authority. That this is a man who is under God's authority. And so as in his humble way, not saying, I have authority as to lead, I too am under authority. And we understand the authority he's talking about is Rome. He's under the authority of Caesar. Right? When he's about to start off in this next section where he says, the guys I asked to do stuff, they do stuff. He's not ever saying they do stuff because I am the authority. No, he fully understands the reason that they obey my orders is because of Rome. Because of Caesar. He carries authority. Do you see the difference? It's not that he has authority. He carries authority. He's under authority. He's a steward of authority, and he knows how to use it. Beloved, this is a great lesson. Young men, this is a great lesson to understand. You know, they always say power corrupts, right? It's because too often when people get into a position of authority, they all of a sudden think it's theirs. They don't realize that they've been entrusted with authority. They don't realize that the authority actually is above them. So many who gain authority believe it's theirs and that the authority rests in themselves. Beloved, it's never the case. These soldiers listen to these orders. I'll tell you, I was in the Air Force. And airmen listen to sergeants, and sergeants listen to chief sergeants, and chief sergeants listen to lieutenants, and lieutenants listen to captains, and captains listen to colonels, colonels listen to generals, generals listen to the civilians. Civilians listen to the commander, who is the president, and the president should be listening to the people. That's how it's built here. Where does the authority rest? In this country. At least it used to, or should. With people. And that every officer carries the authority of that trust. And that's why people obey orders, even into battle, even into death. Because the authority is high. This centurion understood that authority structure and said, I understand that you are carrying the authority of God. You can heal. Because of that authority, he goes on, to the soldiers under me, if I say to one, go, he goes. To another, come, he comes. To my servant, do this, he does that. This centurion is confident that Jesus is under God's authority, and so therefore, God can heal his servant, and even though he is unworthy to presume upon Jesus for himself, realizing there is nothing he can do but call out to this Christ, the one with the authority to save, that's exactly what he does. Please use your authority. And then he goes on, right? You don't have to come and touch him. You don't have to come and see him. I understand authority. If I give an order here, it will be carried out across the seas. Why? Because it carries my name, and my name carries the name of Rome, and Rome's name carries the name of Caesar. And so it will be carried out. My word will have power wherever it goes because of the authority that's bestowed in me. Say a word, and I know that will be carried out. Verse 9. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him. It's a great word. It's only used twice for Jesus in the New Testament. He's only marveling twice. Do you know the two times that he marvels? First off, what does marveling mean, to marvel? It means it's a combination of surprise, wonder, with a little admiration. Surprise, wonder. So two times Jesus was really surprised to the point where it's what causes us to point and say, look at that. Have you ever seen anything like that? The first time you went to the Grand Canyon, the edge of the Grand Canyon, you wanted someone to be there with you so you could go, look at that. You marveled at it. First time you came up to a sequoia tree, look at that. You marveled at it. Surprising how big, scary big. And there's a certain amount of surprise and admiration. It takes you back a little bit. Wow, this is not what I expected. This is bigger than I thought. This is stronger than I thought. This is really something. That's what it means to marvel. Jesus did that twice. That's recorded. First place was in Mark 6, and it's at the unbelief of his family and neighbors when he was rejected in Nazareth. He marveled because of their unbelief. He came home. He's preaching in the local synagogue to his family and brothers, these ones who basically had angels proclaim, right? He's in the area where the angels 30 years earlier had said, this is the one. These are the people who grew up with the Jesus stories. They all knew Mary. They knew Joseph. They knew the family. They knew all the stuff that took place. And as he came back to preach to them, they're like, we don't think that you are who you say you are. We don't like this. And they rejected him, and they were filled with wrath, and they pushed him out. Remember? And as he was being pushed out, he marveled, and he goes, I can't believe this unbelief from you. And here in Luke 7, he marvels at this man's belief, his faith. He marveled at this man's confidence and trust. And so you see one of Luke's contrasts. If you understand these two marvels, right? Jesus marveled at those people who most should have believed and didn't. And he marveled at this centurion who should not have believed, but did. Interesting, isn't it? Here was a man who by all intents and purposes is a Gentile, outside. He's in there as an overlord. He's in this city. And here is this man with this belief. And so Jesus turns to the crowd that follows him, these apostles, disciples, followers. He says, I tell you. And the way he says that, I want you to see what he's saying. He goes, look at this. Listen up. I'm telling you something that you got to hear. You know, this is something to see. This is really something special. All of you, I just got done telling you on that sermon and those series of talks that we just had about what it is to be blessed and what it is to be a woe, what it means to be an authentic follower, what all it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. And here we are. Look at this. This is the real deal. This is what faith looks like. He says, not even in Israel, right? Not even where I would have expected to find it have I found faith like this. I want you to know, beloved, this is not an indictment on Israel, right? This isn't to put them down, to say, oh, you know, you should have faith like this and I got to go find it in a centurion. That's not what he's saying. He's saying this is special. This is worthy of you looking at and considering. I tell you, I haven't seen such faith like this in all of Israel. Jesus told them, and he tells us to look at this faith. What was at the root of this centurion's faith? I am unworthy, undeserving. I do not presume. I don't take for granted. There's nothing I can do but cry out. Jesus, you can heal and save. If only you will. For I know that you're under the authority of the God who saves. I know that you were sent by him, and I know that he is a God who saves. That's the testimony of this centurion, isn't it? So what we find right here, this is his words. I am unworthy. I do not presume. There's nothing I can do. Jesus can heal and save because he was sent by his Father, the one who saves. It's a pretty good gospel, isn't it? And beloved, it isn't his belief that heals and saves. Right? That's one of the errors that some in the church go off on, right? Oh, well, I must not be believing strong enough. I must not have strong enough faith in order to enact this thing. No, it's not his belief that saves. It isn't his faith that heals or saves. It's that his faith, which is a gift of God in itself, is rightly placed in the God who heals and saves. It is God who saves. This is a good faith because it's planted right. It's a good faith because it's rightly pointed, right? The whole thing we talked about in that last sermon was make sure you're pointed right. And what he's saying is here's a faith pointed right. Here's a faith that understands. He doesn't have to say, no, it's not me, it's my Father, because this centurion understands it's his Father. And Jesus carries this authority. When Jesus turned to the crowd and he pointed to this faith, beloved, it wasn't to embarrass them. So often we think Jesus comes across sometimes as kind of pointed because of the way we interpret it. This isn't Jesus going, you should have faith like that. No, it's an invitation, isn't it? When he turns to the crowd, he says, this is the real deal. This is real faith. Oh, that you would have such trust and confidence. Right? When you define faith, full confidence, absolute trust. And what he's saying is, look at the confidence that he has in this. Look at the trust that he has in this. I want you to have that same confidence. I want you to have that same trust. It's not just an invitation to those followers of him on that day, is it? It's also an invitation and a challenge to you that are gathered here this morning. In the same way, because Luke is writing this in such a manner that we might be certain. That we might have this same solid, strong, trusting faith. That we might share in the same confidence. And so it's an invitation even for us as we look at this centurion to say, wow, I've never really thought about it that way. And it makes so much sense the way that the centurion kind of lays it out. To believe and trust in God with the same confidence that Jesus found in this faithful centurion. That's the call we're left with this morning, isn't it? I love verse 10. I love how this section ends. And when they returned to the house, the servant was healed. Their faith was put in the right spot. Right? Their confidence and their trust was rightly placed. It's almost kind of, oh, and by the way, he got healed. Was there ever any doubt? Was there even a question? And what's interesting is we don't ever point out to this healing, and all the commentators say this is the most miraculous of all the healings. You know why? Jesus never came near, never saw the one he healed, never talked to him, never touched him, never spit in the mud, never did anything. Doesn't even say he used a word. Somewhere from the time where he says, I know you can, and he turns to the crowd and says, that's the real deal. This guy was healed. Back however many days away. That's our God. It was right to place his